Film Spotting is presented by PeerFlix. Trade DVDs online at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Dexter, a killer new series presented by Showtime. By day, Dexter Morgan is a likable forensic investigator for Miami Homicide, but by night, he dispenses a special kind of justice. To subscribe, call 1-800-SHOWTIME or go to SHO.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. On tonight's show, reviews of Christopher Nolan's The Prestige and Todd Field's Little Children.
We'll also have a conversation with Todd Field about the follow-up to his Oscar-nominated debut In the Bedroom, plus listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music from The Comfies, and our countdown of the top five movies about deception. But we begin with Christian Bale and Hugh Jackman in The Prestige.
I'll perform this feat in a manner never before seen by yourselves or any other audience anywhere in the world.
The audience loved it.
This trick is top-notch.
We need to celebrate.
A real magician tries to invent something new.
God.
It's something that other magicians will scratch their heads over.
I suppose you have such a trick.
Actually, I do. It's the one they're going to remember me for.
Sam, I don't know if you saw this or not, but if you go to the Internet Movie Database and look at the plot outline for The Prestige, you'll find this. Robert and Alfred are rival magicians. When Alfred performs the ultimate magic trick, Robert tries desperately to find out the secret to the trick. The outline, of course, it's accurate, but it makes me, I don't know about you, but makes me immediately imagine a movie starring Jack Black and Paul Giamatti as
rival
wacky,
magicians,
hack magicians,
hats
constantly,
and capes
yeah,
and, yeah.
constantly trying to one-up each other. Maybe you throw in a zany, wacky Sam Rockwell as a nightclub owner or someone in there, you know, a sidekick.
I want someone to write this film.
Right. But this is a Christopher Nolan film, the same director who gave us Memento, Insomnia, and he put the dark back in Dark Knight with his recent Batman prequel, Batman Begins. Robert and Alfred here aren't goofy entertainers. They're obsessed, morally challenged artists who simply cannot be happy unless the other is miserable or worse. The Prestige is the second turn-of-the-century magic movie we've reviewed in the last 2 months. It's the new hot genre, apparently.
Yes.
The Illusionist
Goodbye,
with Ed Norton.
Goodbye, pirates. Hello. Turn of the century.
No more
magicians.
Pirates,
yes.
Magicians. The Illusionist with Ed Norton and the aforementioned Paul Giamatti is the other. I love The Illusionist. You did not. Who is the better cinematic magician, The Illusionist Neil Berger or Christopher Nolan?
All right. Well, to answer that question, I think of The Prestige. You've got Michael Caine's character, Cutter. He's a theatrical agent who works with both of the film's competing magicians, Bale and Jackman. And he narrates portions of the film and acts almost as a guide through the architecture of magic.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he explains the power of magic, that as educated people, sophisticated, civilized people, we know that the world is solid, that there are rules to it. But that magic, when it's done right, makes us doubt what we know is true. And Berger's film, The Illusionist, does not succeed in accomplishing that, I don't think. Instead, I think he makes a pretty boring revenge story laced with a totally ineffective romance and some occasionally interesting magic. Nolan in The Prestige, I think, gets it completely right. The movie, I think, ingeniously uses the structure of a magic act. I mean, the very first line of the movie, we get this unusual, pay very close attention, yeah, and uses the pledge, the turn, and The Prestige to tell the story, and is consistently revealing things to you and then introducing some other mystery. And just like a great magic act, left me puzzling over the movie for hours after I saw it. In fact, the most satisfying part of the movie could be the hours after you leave the theater.
Maybe.
With, hopefully, a friend of yours, and piece it all back together.
Yeah, no, I agree with you there. That's exactly where I'll start. Ultimately, I disagree with you, and we're not going to rehash our review of The Illusionist. You can go back and find it on the filmspotting.net site, but we disagreed about it, as I said, and I still think The Illusionist is the better film, but for me, this was a film that started out, when it was immediately over, being a 3-star movie. When we give star ratings on our website.
You liked it.
I liked it. I would recommend it to people, but I was underwhelmed for some reason, and I know a couple of the reasons why, and we'll get into them. But I think the big reason why I was underwhelmed is that, like a lot of movies full of these twists and turns, which this movie ultimately has, a lot of deception going on, those twists can actually be too much. My head starts spinning, and rather than being excited by it, I start to lose my patience. David Mamet, his The Spanish Prisoner is
sure.
a film like that for me, where I just run out of patience with it, as opposed to a much tighter film like Inside Man, Spike Lee's Inside Man. I'm with it the entire time. But The Prestige is really a movie, you're absolutely right, that gets better the more you think about it, because what's really interesting about it if not totally unique, is that the movie gets better when you start to realize that what is really fascinating isn't the cleverness of the twists, which a lot of times with a movie like The Usual Suspects, you want to go back and see how things maybe piece together, even a movie like Inside Man, but it's the emotional ramifications of the twists. You start to realize the full extent of characters' relationships to each other and the whole concept
and
of
their motivations.
This film deals with. I mean, I've seen some critics kind of just limit this movie to being one about pure entertainment, and really, it's much more than that. If you think about it in the grand scheme of Christopher Nolan's body of work, you've got this concept of these magicians being completely obsessed by what they do, and it's about that sacrifice that having that kind of obsession requires, and not to mention the kind of moral just emptiness that you need to have. I watched this film, and I thought immediately of Woody Allen and Bullets Over Broadway. There's a line where one of the characters in it, I believe it's Chaz Palminteri, who says that the artist creates his own moral universe. And you've got here, these magicians are basically artists who have completely created their own moral universe to accomplish whatever they want to accomplish. And that's what hit me at the end of the film. I said to you, we actually saw this movie together. We don't get that opportunity a lot. And when the credits came up and it said, directed by Christopher Nolan, I was like, I'd completely forgotten that. Of course, I knew it. We've been anticipating this movie, and that was a big reason why, because we love Memento, and he's an interesting director. But I'd completely forgotten, and something about the film didn't even make me think of it as a Christopher Nolan film. I don't think it's visually as inventive, which isn't a knock on it, but I don't think it's as stylistic as some of his other films. But then you realize later, you sit down and really break it down and think about the characters, and you realize that it's absolutely a Christopher Nolan film. Memento, Insomnia, Batman Begins, they're all about characters who have made that decision to do whatever it is they want to do or what they think they need to do, and it's kind of the end justifies the means. They've made their own. They've absolutely created their own moral universe.
I love that you brought up the idea of the emotional ramifications, because it brings up one of the minor quibbles I had with the film, but also the satisfaction of it. You're absolutely right. Some of the scenes where I was unclear on the motivations of characters or their interactions is fulfilled. I mean, I felt like emotionally unsatisfied in some portions of the film, and then thinking about it afterwards, the way it fills in the gaps, it's really incredible and unlike anything I can really readily think of. And I do want to say, though, I do want to point out, I do think that Nolan does have a kind of insensitivity dealing with relationships on screen. I mean, he and his brother, Jonathan, who he wrote the script with, I think ingenious plotters. I really defy someone to tell me what's wrong with this film structurally. I think it's ingenious. But there are moments where we have characters interacting together, even those things that are ultimately revealed to be different than we expected. I do think that he handles sometimes the cleverness of the script with the same kind of tools that, you know, with these emotional elements of the, you know, and there's a heavy-handedness with some of that, where he doesn't seem to have the same kind of comfort in relationships. Of course, in Memento, you don't have that problem.
Right.
This person can't develop relationships with new people. His relationship is with his dead wife.
Same with his other films, too.
And I want to say, too, I mean, Batman. You think of Batman Begins, you get a problem where, yes, Katie Holmes is seriously miscast in the film, but also that relationship never lives on screen. But that being said, it's one of the sort of minor things I have to say about it. I really just had a blast.
Yeah, well, my other quibble with it, I guess, the other thing that keeps me from really probably loving it as much as you did, is that there's a scene in it with Bale and his wife, Christian Bale, who we haven't even talked about the performances yet.
Man.
But Christian Bale plays Borden, and he does a trick for his wife, or who becomes his wife, Sarah, and she wants to know how it works. She says, come on, tell me. And he violates the magician's oath or whatever and says, okay, but you can't tell anyone else. He tells her how it works, and her reaction is something along the lines of, wow, it always seems so simple and kind of stupid. You know what
right,
I mean? Like,
yeah.
She's basically like completely now unimpressed by
right, by
the
magic,
trick
yeah,
because
yeah.
she knows how it really works.
Yeah.
And once that intrigue or the mystery has been taken away, it doesn't really work for anymore. I think that what The Illusionist gets right with its ending, despite the way it's shot, I didn't approve of. But when we get to the end of it, when the prestige, the final turn of, you know, of the magic act is revealed, the final act of the trick, there's still mystery there because it's subjective. It's a subjective interpretation. And there's enough holes in what you're seeing that you still have things to fill in. There's still mystery. You get to the end of The Prestige, I felt a little bit like Sarah. Once the trick was revealed to me, I just kind of felt like an idiot that I hadn't picked it up along the way. I was just as kind of, oh, that's how it worked? Like she was. I wasn't really amazed at the artistry of it anymore. You're just kind of, you know, I was kind of just mad at myself for not figuring it out.
See, I felt like that actually contributed to the emotional power of it, what is revealed ultimately. And I have to say, I'm I'm so glad I saw this film early. It's opening weekend, because I feel like to talk about it at all, to hear people talk about it at all, of course I didn't read any reviews or anything like that, I think would change how I went into this film.
Yeah.
So maybe it's too late to warn people not to listen, but I really encourage people to see this, and I think part of the satisfaction of it is not knowing.
Well,
and I love, too, I mean, if you're familiar with the trailer, how much of that is revealed early in the film,
mm-hmm.
whereas there's so much left of the film that isn't revealed. And I do want to say, too, because you didn't mention this, is if there's another problem at all with the film, it's that a key part of its resolution requires a very, very significant suspension of disbelief. And I did struggle with it. Ultimately,
okay.
I made peace with it. But I have to say, I think it's the kind of thing that will trouble some people, too, because
maybe.
It's unexpected and disrupts the reality of the film.
Well, I like what you were saying about how maybe it is the kind of film that you should go see before you hear much about it or
yeah.
read much about it. But that said, I hope that we've done, and I think we've done a good job of really not talking about any specifics
Agreed.
Of the story at
Agreed.
All here in these Magicians. Let's close out real quick. I think you'll agree with me that the performances
Bale,
here
yeah.
are I think they're uniformly good, but especially Christian Bale. I think maybe his best performance, and maybe his most natural, actually. We talked about after the movie, he can be really vicious, and he's
mm-hmm.
just really dark, and he's the complete opposite of Jackman, who is kind of the prototype leading man with his smile and his hair and his teeth and his physique and his voice. It's all perfect.
It's perfect.
But I think he is a layered actor and a layered and gives a layered performance here. But Bale, really, he draws you in just like his character with that mystery.
There's
that
a menace
darkness.
To it. Yeah.
There's a menace to it and a complexity, just like he brought to Bruce Wayne and Batman. And I think that's got to be that darkness is obviously what Christopher Nolan likes in him.
Yeah, I can't say enough about Christian Bale either. I think it's just, and it is, it's something really, really compelling because he gives you reason, I think, early in the film not to like or sympathize with his character.
Mm-hmm.
And the performance makes you sympathize with him.
Yeah.
The film is really dark, I think, and has to overcome that. Really great. Well, if you've seen The Prestige and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net. We may not get a chance to respond, but we will definitely read your email.
After the break, Todd Field's debut film In the Bedroom got 5 Oscar nominations. His latest, Little Children, is already garnering Oscar buzz. We'll review it next, and later in the show, we'll hear from Field himself. Stay with us. There's a right way.
Nice place.
You think so?
Yeah.
Well, Richard does all right for himself.
What's he do again?
Lies.
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar, and that's Kate Winslet and Patrick Wilson in an early scene from Little Children.
That's right, and as we mentioned, Todd Field's debut film, 2001's In the Bedroom, did receive 5 Oscar nominations, including 2 for Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Little Children, Field's new film, is based on the 2004 satirical novel by Tom Perata, also the author of Election, which Alexander Payne adapted for the screen brilliantly in 1999 with Matthew Broderick and Reese Witherspoon. There are children in Little Children, but the children in the title refer instead to the listless suburban adults in the story, particularly Kate Winslet's Sarah, an overeducated housewife, and Patrick Wilson's Brad, a stay-at-home father who can't pass the bar. The other adult children in the film include Sarah and Brad's spouses, played by Jennifer Connelly and Greg Edelman, and Jackie Earle Haley as Ronnie, a man recently released from prison who has returned to his hometown after spending 3 years in jail for indecent exposure to a minor. Adam, you've said that Field's debut film, In the Bedroom, was robbed in 2001, that if it was up to you, it would have won Best Picture that year. Little Children may be about a group of upper-middle-class suburban New Englanders, not unlike In the Bedroom, but Little Children is a very different film. Now, do you think Field handles Little Children's satirical melodrama as well as he did the psychological drama of In the Bedroom?
Well, it is interesting because I wrote at the time in my memo to the Academy,
right,
when I was writing for the Daily Iowa,
March 2002, yeah.
Apparently my memo got lost in the mail or something, but I wrote, what will win the Best Picture Award? It will be A Beautiful Mind. What should win? I had In the Bedroom. And what I wrote, I said it has a pitch-perfect screenplay, Field's lyrical direction and brilliant performances from its entire cast made In the Bedroom the biggest surprise of 2001. With a measly $2 million at his disposal, Field proved that great filmmaking isn't about big-name stars or a big-time budget. It's about passion. And the reason I'm reading that is rereading that for the first time just 30 minutes ago. It caught my attention because I hadn't read it in years, and I think a lot of the same things apply with this film, the strong script, the lyrical direction, the great performances. But the biggest thing was that word passion. Because I don't know if you think of either really film as all that passionate, but I remember why I wrote it, and it's because I remember this feeling, this emotional core just swelling beneath In the Bedroom, just throbbing, which really adds to the tension of it and makes it such, for me, a powerful film. And you have it here as well, but it's more in the passion for the material. It's a more ambitious film than In the Bedroom. It's more postmodern. It incorporates narration in a really interesting and now unconventional way, this third person voiceover,
voice of God,
which we just don't get anymore. And it's got a really interesting kind of bold visual style because of its ambition and that theatricality to it. I don't know that it packs that emotional wallop that In the Bedroom does, but I did really like the film, and I think he handles this film. I mean, he's experimenting, he's expanding as a filmmaker. I really liked it.
Yeah, I did too. And it's funny, it was enjoyable in a way I'm not sure I've ever experienced before. I can't compare the experience of watching Little Children to another kind of enjoyable film experience. Certainly not The Prestige. My God, I mean, yes, an enjoyable experience. This, it's interesting. I was thinking about the adaptation that Field did with Parada, the author of the novel. And I think what must have appealed to Field, as I think we've heard him say, is the tone of Parada's writing. What does he sound like? What's it like to read his writing? And you finish the book, and it reminded me of books I think I've finished. And you try to describe what the book's about, and it's not what the book's about that makes it so compelling. It's the feeling of what it's like to read it, to be caught up in the tone, the writer's, just the writer's whole tone. And I think what Field managed to do that, I wonder if it's difficult to do for other adapters of books. People might love the book, but instead they focus on the plot and they bring those characters.
Sure.
Those don't come to life. That's not really the interesting thing. And I think he's so successful. I haven't read Little Children.
No.
But I think what he's managed to do is bring a tone to the film. That's why I recommend this film, because the tone is consistent.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the suspense of it really is not so much what the characters are doing. I think it's not the fact that we have two characters that are engaged in an affair. Are they going to be found out by their spouses? It's what he reveals about characters, mm-hmm, at certain times.
Yeah.
And I think it's just really smart filmmaking. I think the screenplay is just ingenious. And his able to sustain that tone is, I think, is incredible.
Well, he gets something right from the book, even though we haven't read it. He should, because he collaborated with Parada on the screenplay. And as you'll hear him say in our interview here in the next segment, he really started out with that narration and that voice, just trying to capture Parada's voice. And I love what you said about how he didn't focus on the plot of it. You're right, that's the big mistake you could probably make. And how many details do I fit in? He really, it seems, went after here the mood and that voice and that kind of lyrical quality to it. And I think he really hits on something. And I have to give you some credit, Sam, here, which is something I don't like to do, actually, because I've disagreed with you on this, and a lot of listeners have disagreed with you on this before. But I understood for the first time watching Little Children what your problem is with American Beauty, another movie about suburbia. The cynicism of it you always talked about you didn't like. And what I realized is there's maybe some truth there, because Alan Ball with American Beauty has the eye of an outsider, and he filters these characters through his prism and mocks them in a way. And Field clearly isn't interested in that. You see it in his choice to make the judgment of these characters come from the characters themselves. The opening scene of Sarah at this playground with these other mothers, it's all from her point of view, the way it's shot and the way she's hearing it. It's her perception. It's how she chooses to see these people and hear them. And she's judging them just in the way that she thinks they're being wrong to judge other people. Field clearly is not interested in trying to make some kind of big statement about suburbia. Again, another thing he'll talk about in our interview, but that's not what he's after here. And I just have to give you some credit because I see that difference, and I like that difference. I like the fact that this is a movie that is bleak and kind of sarcastic and cynical and ironic, but it doesn't have that desperation contempt. Or contempt on some level that a movie like American Beauty does.
I do think so, and I think to point out that scene, I think you're right. I mean, yes, we have Kate Winslet, Sarah's perspective of these, yes, these stay-at-home moms, these very conventional suburban housewives. But the thing is, too, additionally, is that these three housewives are not caricatures, like a chorus of caricatures, of housewife caricatures. Each of them has their own subtle personality.
They're unique,
They're unique. Mm-hmm. And I think Field obviously cares enough about them to bring that out. But also, I think what's really interesting is that, you know, he's described this film, I think he describes the book and would describe the film, as this satirical melodrama, which is a really interesting idea. And we get this sense that, I got this sense anyway, that the performances themselves, I don't think you could, if you were just to see the performances outside of the artifice, outside of the narration or the way that Field, you know, photographs this film, I think you would see it as a very sincere drama of characters, just the way they're interacting and their relationships. It really is the artifice, the wonderful narration, the way that Field films the story that actually makes it satirical, but not at all
contemptuous.
It's not contemptuous. And I think that's what, so there's a wonderful, like, sincerity and heart to the way the characters, and they're not just serving a purpose. They're not just serving like a cynical or allegorical purpose, but they're elevated to the to a sense of allegorical quality.
Yeah, and that heightened reality of it is something that really drew me in right away. You've got these characters, and this gets back to this kind of postmodern idea. I mean, Field says something great where he says that these are people who are all worried that they're living a cliche rather than worried about their own identities, rather than just living their lives. And you think about it for a second. Did people 20 years ago or even 50 years ago have to worry about whether or not they were living a cliche?
This living in a postmodern sensibility.
In the postmodern world we can sit here and worry about and cause these kind of problems for ourselves. Right. And you see early on in the film that these people are all existing in this kind of postmodern fantasy world where there's a lot of distractions and distractions by technology. TVs featured prominently. It opens on a television news story. The internet. Sarah, her husband, becomes obsessed with internet porn. That's his diversion from life. And there's a heightened quality to everything that I loved. I actually even thought that Jennifer Connelly, we see her in a scene, be this kind of cold wife throughout. She doesn't really realize. She's not a bad person, but she doesn't realize the way she treats her husband isn't really good or that it makes him unhappy. She only really is moved to be caring when she's watching footage of a documentary she's making where a boy is talking about losing his father in Iraq. She needs almost that visual stimulation to prompt her to really care and want to pick up the phone and call her husband and say, hey, how are you guys doing? It's interesting, that kind of outside stimuli. You see it throughout the entire film. And again, you know, the narration about the film, it violates a lot of rules that people probably will not like. Namely, people always talk about how narration should, you know, you should just show us and not tell us. And if narration is being redundant, telling us stuff we can already see for ourselves or already know, then it's not serving our purpose. There's a little bit of that quality here, but it's so interesting. And the way the language is used, actually, and I'll just mention quickly a scene, I won't get into the details of it, but there's a scene with Jennifer Connelly where she realizes something at a dinner table about the nature of the relationship between a couple of characters. And the way the narration describes that scene is beautifully metaphoric and completely, even though we can see on her face what she's feeling, the way it's described is so moving in itself that it justifies the narration throughout the entire film.
Because it's as powerful as it would be if you were reading it in a novel.
Yeah.
And I think that's what, sometimes, you know, you bring prose from a novel and it's sort of shoehorned into lazily, like you said, because it furthers the action or comments redundantly on the action. In this case, it has the same power where if you were reading the novel, you'd have that scenario in your head, you'd picture those characters where they are, and you'd know what everyone was thinking. And then the line that Field chooses to use hits you like a ton of bricks because of the description.
Yep.
I did want, you brought up Jennifer Connelly's character, and it's one of my quibbles with it is that some of the supporting characters I feel like aren't really fleshed out, particularly not so much Jennifer Connelly, but Kate Winslet's husband, Sarah's husband. We have a whole scene with him in the beginning, a whole segment really, where we go into his private life.
Yeah.
Then he's abandoned, and largely it seems to justify Kate Winslet's behavior the rest of the film. You never quite believe that they're a couple, that they're a married couple, that they married at any point. And I think there are a few cases, I think, in the film where characters are used to justify the behavior of other characters, or are there solely to justify certain behavior. I almost want to say that about the Ronnie character, the person that's just been released for indecent exposure. I'm conflicted about how that character is used. I think it's kind of brilliant in the way it's used in terms of how other characters behave around him,
right.
But ultimately how he's used, I'm left a little conflicted, honestly.
Okay. Well, you know, Field is this director who we're going to have an interview with him here next. He doesn't really want to draw attention to himself as a filmmaker, but he does here, and not in a bad way. It doesn't overpower the story, but it's rhetorical enough that you can't overlook his style. I mean, he clearly has a lot of promise as a director. I mean, he's a guy who we can't wait to see what he would come up with next. We could talk a lot about this film, but we probably need to move on, Sam. So if you've seen Little Children, we want to hear what you think. Send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net.
That's right, and when Film Spotting returns, Adam's conversation with Little Children director and co-writer Todd Field. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Hallgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. You can listen to Film Spotting right here on Chicago Public Radio the last Saturday of every month. Film Spotting is also available as a weekly podcast. For more information or to subscribe, go to filmspotting.net. Sam, we also want to quickly thank the Comfies and Livewire Recordings for tonight's music.
Idle hands spend time at the genitals, and you know how much God hates that.
That's a clip from the Cartoon Network's Aqua Teen Hunger Force. The character, a piece of mold named Old Drippy. The voice, none other than writer-director Todd Field, who you, Adam, recently had a chance to speak with about his new film, the film we just reviewed, Little Children.
We're here on Film Spotting with Todd Field, the director and Oscar-nominated screenwriter of 2001's In the Bedroom. His new movie is Little Children. Todd, thank you so much for joining me.
No, thank you for having me.
You've had a chance to correspond a little bit with my co-host, Sam. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here, but he has requested that you do the entire interview in the voice of Old Drippy. Is that possible?
I wish I could.
Yeah.
That would be really interesting. I might lose my voice.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I really want to focus on Little Children, but I know we have a lot of listeners who are filmmakers and aspiring filmmakers, and I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about how you made the transition from actor to director. You've played 30-plus parts on TV and film since the mid-'80s. Was being a filmmaker always your goal?
Yes, from the very beginning. I made films as soon as I could get my hands on any equipment, and I used to volunteer. Even as a young actor in New York, I used to volunteer on NYU projects and pull cable or do anything that I could behind the camera just to be able to get near it. But as soon as I could make films, I did. 92 is when I sort of stopped looking for work as an actor and spent 3 years as a directing fellow at the AFI. Yeah, I was fortunate to be able to have experience working, you know, with filmmakers and watching their different approaches. And that's a fairly privileged position to be in so much as that even once you've started to make films, it's rare, other than maybe the odd day on a set of someone else's film, are you able to watch someone else and their methods.
Well, Little Children is a film about many things: marriage, infidelity, parenthood, suburbia. We could go on. How do you describe it, though?
A rip-roaring comedy. I'm very bad at those things.
Yeah.
When I was a fellow at the AFI, they had a class there, like a pitch class, where you go in and sort of tell everybody, you know, this is my big idea. And I always thought if I could do that, I probably wouldn't want to make it, because there's initial interest in material that you're conscious of, and then there's something gnawing at you that is not conscious, and that you're glad is not conscious, because you want to discover it and not run out of gas, you know, for 2+ years on a project. But something besides a film, I mean, I think my reaction to Tom Parada's novel, the two sort of primary things that struck me had to do with this sort of state of anxiety that I was feeling, you know, in our country at the time, and that the book felt like a fairly profound allegory for that. Also the fact that I hadn't read Parada before, and starting that book, I found myself giggling like an idiot, and about halfway through I found myself not giggling anymore, and feeling very different things and surprising things that were completely unexpected.
Well, I know that you've described the book as satirical melodrama. Is that also how you would describe the film, and how challenging was it to maintain that tone? I mean, did you have any trouble communicating with your actors about walking that kind of a line?
Well, satirical melodrama, you know, is a hybrid genre. I mean, it's not. We're very comfortable with embracing something like, you know, Almodovar's films. They're all melodrama. Some of them are satirical melodrama as well, but it's not a genre that people are leaping to, you know, embrace in the States. It's not about a consistent tone. It's about a modulating tone that shifts. And the template for that was very clear, which was the novel. You know, as I said, it starts out and you think it's one thing, and you think, oh, this is going to be some kind of send up of suburbia, which I had no interest in. And even though I could, you know, it was a guilty pleasure to sort of laugh and think that that's what it was. And then I realized, no, that's not what this is at all. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's very, you know, it's a very melodramatic, full of feeling exploration of characters who are doing the judging, who are actually judging the environment. And it is not the author judging the environment. It's these characters who are terrified that they're living out some kind of cliche, when in fact they're refusing to deal with their own identities.
I see those women over there. Yeah, don't look. You know what they call you?
What?
The prom king.
Oh, God. Really?
Yeah, they mean it as a compliment. You're a big character in their fantasy lives.
Wow.
So one of them bet me $5 I couldn't get your phone number.
$5, huh?
Yeah.
But could we split it 50-50?
It could be arranged.
You're listening to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio. My guest is Todd Field. His new movie is Little Children. And I want to ask you about this idea of not wanting to send up the suburbs, because it is clear that from the opening shots of the movie, you recognize through the sound design and the visual style that this is definitely a heightened reality, and these characters all do seem to exist in a sort of fantasy world. The mother's on the playground. Kate Winslet's character, Sarah, even says at one point that her relationship with Brad isn't real. And when they finally do kiss, it is this genuinely earth-shattering moment, because it's something genuine amidst things that seem artificial. And I'm wondering if this kind of disillusionment is specific to these characters in this setting, or is it something more universal?
Well, I mean, I think it's universal. And in fact, probably the only hesitation I had about approaching this adaptation of this novel was that it would ever be misconstrued as a suburban send-up. First of all, I think that's been done very well by many writers and many filmmakers, and further comment is definitely not necessary. It's interesting what you say. I would agree about the lack of reality. I think the feeling that's very – a feeling that had meaning for us simply as almost a memory piece, sort of coupled with a sort of visual approach that's more like a Gregory Crutzen photograph where something's just not quite right. But it's not the suburbs. It's not any suburbs that anyone would recognize. It has a theatrical feeling to it, and it's meant to. It's much more like a stage play, like a postmodern, our town, where we have a third-person narrative sort of standing in for the stage manager.
I wanted to ask you about that very thing, the use of narration here, because it is something that is a clear sign of that kind of feeling and that heightened reality, and especially the fatherly tone of it. And I think that we've sort of become accustomed, obviously, to hearing characters voicing over comments about themselves and their personal insights. But here we've got this kind of voice of God. I think it's the kind of thing that some moviegoers will embrace, as I did. Others might find it cumbersome or distracting. What was your rationale behind it?
Oh, well, the idea of it was very simple. And the first thing that I was really interested in about the book, more than anything, was discovering this man's voice, that being Tom Perata. The way he was able to dance in and out of these characters' interior life fairly invisibly, he eases you in and out of their lives without it feeling as if his narrative has changed. I had to read it about a half a dozen times to see that how his skill and his artistry and the change of a phrase ever so slightly, he modulates through his narrative thread through that novel. It's pretty mind-boggling. And also how he takes us, again, from it being pure satire right into melodrama. And I wasn't keen to lose that. I didn't feel like I needed any rationale for it because I thought it would be effective for that reason. It felt exciting for that reason. And I wanted to keep as much Perata in the film as possible because, of course, that's why I was excited about it. It was the first time I had met him as a reader. I would have been terrible to have lost that.
I have to ask you about the visual strategy of the film, too. One thing I noticed right away is how flat the compositions seem to be. There are a lot of close-ups, and the characters really seem locked into their environment. There's no real depth between them and their surrounding, which I think adds, again, to that kind of sense of reality that you're going for, the heightened sense. How did you and your cinematographer approach the visual strategy of this film?
I do my own camera blocking. It's not really a conversation I have with anyone else, to be honest with you. And that's a very instinctual thing for me. My background is in photography. That's part of the, I think, probably one of my main attractions to wanting to make my own films, because that's my performance as a filmmaker, as opposed to being in front of a camera. And because the amount of, it's the only way to make personal films. I mean, and I would consider this, even though this is really, you know, there are many shoulders that this film is standing on. That's the only, contribution that I have potentially that's meaningful for me. And it's an instinctual one. I wouldn't, if I began to talk about it, it would, become a fairly muddled academic mess to say I did this or I did that, and this is why I was on a 35-millimeter lens, or this is why I was on an 18-millimeter lens, or this is why I moved the camera, or this is why I didn't. I mean, that typically comes out of rehearsals with my actors, and what I like to do is get on to my locations or my sets alone with my actors, weeks ahead of time, and typically the camera blocking comes out of what they're doing.
Is there a typical day in rehearsal? What's it like?
No, there's not a typical day. I mean, it's all part of process. I mean, the one thing about process that's hard is you have a really long road to go, from the moment you say, okay, I'm going to try to do this and try to approach it with some kind of humility and say, I don't know anything. And you don't. You know nothing when you start a film other than that this interests me. And I hope that it continues to interest me. And I pray that at the end of this process, it will still interest me. and that I will have found something along the way. I mean, you really have to approach everything with that kind of true humility, because the thing is that you have no idea which way it's going to go. And there are plenty of people that with the best of intentions, you know, you start a project and it goes in a way that either in a way that is more interesting than you could have imagined or is a disaster. I mean, you're taking a leap of faith every single time. The reason that it's so valuable is because no matter how much you imagine these other characters, no matter how much you spend all night thinking about it, or you and your writing partner or you alone do a pass for one character and think, who is this person? You don't have to perform it. And in having to perform it, you approach it in a very practical way, and you ask an entire set of questions for yourself as an actor that you can't possibly do with every character in the script stage. And so oftentimes actors will show up, and either because of an idea they have or a piece of interpretation from the text that's different than what your intent was, which is potentially more interesting or more specific, or because of just a question where they say, I don't understand this. Why is it like this? And you say, well, it's because of this and this. And they say, yeah, but if it's like this and this, then what about this? And then you say, yeah, that's interesting. And how does so-and-so feel about this because if she's doing this? And then you say, well, that's a good question. Well, let's figure that out. And that's an exciting time, because ultimately we go to the movies to watch ourselves. We go to the movies to watch other people. We don't go there to watch camera moves, and we don't go there to listen to the music, and we don't go there to hopefully admire any of the elements of filmmaking. We go there to get lost in ourselves. And so your actors are going to be your most valuable collaborators, and it's important that you have actors that you admire and that you you want them to know that you value their opinions, and that there's no such thing as a bad idea. Because if you have an environment like that, very dynamic things hopefully will happen that wouldn't otherwise. And because a script it's important you have a solid script, but it's a dead thing until they show up.
Well, I know you're extremely busy right now promoting the movie, heading off to Paris soon. I can't thank you enough for your time.
All right, thank you. I appreciate the time. It was a good conversation with you.
Time for one last quick break. When we come back, Liars, Cheats, Imposters, and Con Men, our top five movies about deception, is next. Stay with us.
She cuts me back. I'm missing department side. My company. Yeah. That's what she gets.
Invited. That's my corn out there. You guys are guests in my corn.
Right.
No, wait. I have done everything I've been asked to do. I didn't understand it, but I've done it. And I haven't once asked what's in it for me.
What are you saying, Ray?
I'm saying, what's in it for me?
Is that why you did this? For you?
Welcome back to Film Spotting on Chicago Public Radio with Sam Van Halgren. I'm Adam Kempinar. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where we absolutely ruin a great film, a great screenplay, right, and you get a shot at a free DVD.
That's right. A few weeks ago, right here on Chicago Public Radio, Adam and I and special guest D.B. Sweeney massacred the scene you just heard coming out of the break from Field of Dreams with Kevin Costner, Ray Liotta, and James Earl Jones, a tie-in with our top five movies about starting over. Adam, reach into that film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Lainey Trotter from New Orleans, Louisiana.
Lainey Trotter, great name.
It is a great name. Congratulations, Lainey. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with the DVD of your choice.
Now, you guys got to look menacing. Can you be more menacing?
Time now for this week's edition of Massacre Theater, but before we get to it, Sam, we just want to briefly congratulate all of our listeners out there, all
yes.
of our insightful, smart listeners who caught how clever we were trying to be.
I'm not sure there were as many as I expected there
to be.
That's
true, but we thought we were being very clever by having D.B. Sweeney reprise his role as Joe Jackson. He played Joe Jackson in Eight Men Out, the John Sayles film, and of course we thought we were being very smart to have him play Joe Jackson again, but do the Ray Liotta version.
In fact, we had a couple listeners write in like, what a coincidence.
Yeah.
Did you notice?
Yeah.
Did you know, in fact, that D.B. Sweeney played Shoeless Joe Jackson in John Sayles' Eight Men Out? Of course
we did.
We knew.
A movie we both like, and actually, I will say, as much as you know, Ray Liotta's good and we love Field of Dreams, he's the definitive Shoeless Joe. So
well said.
Thanks again to D.B. for sitting in on that segment and acting us under the bus.
As some
really
people also pointed out.
Yeah. This week's Massacre Theater scene, it ties in, Sam, with our top five topic we're going to get to here in a second, movies about deception.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we'll clarify that a little bit more here as we get into the segment, but just think about movies where, you know, there's liars and
cheats, scoundrels.
Yeah, betrayal going
con
on.
Men.
Con men. There you go. Okay, Sam, you start it, so I will give you the action. And action.
What did you do? Have a fight?
No.
Father loading up the shotgun?
What? Please.
It's happened before, you know. Some of the world's happiest marriages have started under the gun, as you might say.
No. She's just not the girl for me.
Yeah, she's only perfect.
She's too perfect. She's too talented. She's too beautiful. She's too sophisticated. She's too everything. But what I want
is what you want, something you can discuss
and scene.
Nicely done, I think.
No, it really wasn't.
I thought there was a nice classic feel to that.
Sure. Our timing, we had the timing
great
down.
Great timing.
I certainly did not have the voice down, but that was kind of by design, too, a little bit. So if you know what film Sam and I just massacred, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on the Film Spotting podcast on Wednesday, November 1st. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net. Okay, top five time.
Yes.
Movies about deception. And Sam, let's just clarify right off the top of this segment here. We left out some subcategories of movies about deception because we've covered them on previous editions of our podcast. Obviously, any movie that is about adultery,
forget it.
Usually,
done it.
Any movie that is twist endings,
forget it.
Yeah, forget it. We've done it because those are obviously going to be about deception. And let's just briefly review the movies that made those lists for us. We did way back on episode number 69. We did our top five cheating hearts movies about adultery. Sam, your list number five, The English Patient. Number four, Eyes Wide Shut, a nice reference to Todd Field there.
Right.
Played Nick Nightingale.
Well, it's piano player.
From Eyes Wide Shut. Number three, The Secret Lies of Dentist. Number two, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. And number one, A Tie, In the Mood for Love, and Yee.
That's right, and you had number five, Eyes Wide Shut, A Tie, Eyes Wide Shut, and Closer, then Breaking the Waves. Your number three was Match Point. And number two, Damage, and number one, A Tie, a Woody Allen tie. Crimes and Misdemeanors, and Hannah and Her Sisters. So,
and just to cover our bases, Sam, when
so throw
we
out
did,
your lists, everyone.
That's right.
Deception.
When we did our twist ending show, we had a guest host on that show. My top five, though, Matchstick Men, Rosemary's Baby, The Usual Suspects, House of Games, and The Empire Strikes Back. So you can officially
right.
now take those 15 movies, put them out of the running.
That's
they cannot
right.
be included in this category.
It will not be considered.
Sam, how did you form your list, and give us your number five?
All right. Basically, it came down to there were films that I sort of put on a preliminary list that had components of deception in them. But I feel like these films are, and I hope I'm not wrong here as I go through the list, but are substantially about deception, about one person deceiving another, sometimes the filmmaker deceiving you, but primarily characters deceiving one another, deeply entrenched deception. My number five, playwright and screenwriter and now director Neil LaBute's first cinema modern-day morality play, In the Company of Men, about the cruelty of men. Aaron Eckhart and Matt Malloy play two men on a prolonged business trip and decide to punish a single woman, really, but women in general, for all of the ills they imagine that women have brought to men. The plot is so cruel, I almost feel like an accomplice with them, just to describe it. But briefly, you do have these two men who pretend to be in love with this woman in order to crush her spiritually.
A deaf woman, no
I was
less.
Going to say. That okay. woman is a deaf woman. A brutal, brutal plot. And of course, Aaron Eckhart, I think, you know, couldn't walk down the street for years afterwards because of his performance. The character's name is escaping me.
Chad.
Chad, of course, yeah. Just because of the brutality of this performance. Of course, Neil LaBute is known for this kind of testing of our wills in terms of like putting us in very, very uncomfortable positions. And this is cruel, but I think it's still his best film, honestly. I still think it's still effective without sort of hitting you over the head with a morality tale in some way. The performances are great. It's really tough to watch, but... certainly when it comes down to deception.
Yeah, no, it's a great choice, and that's one I completely forgot about and wish I hadn't because it is a great film. My number five is a film that was one of my top 10 films of last year. I believe it was number 8, but it should have been higher, frankly, I think, looking back on it now. And it's Michael Haneke's Cachet. This is a film set in France where Juliette Binoche plays a wife in it, and Daniel Auteuil is the husband, and they have a son. It's a very nice middle-class bourgeois family in Paris, and they start getting mysterious videotapes of someone videotaping them, and they don't know who's behind it, and they keep trying to find out, and by the end, I'm not sure that anybody really knows who is ultimately behind it, but there is a deception going on that's more a kind of self-deception, clearly with the main character, Daniel Auteuil, where he's really hiding something from his past that comes back in a major way to haunt him, but there's also just these little character deceptions throughout where everyone is clearly hiding something in this film, and it's a film that really blew me away, still sticks with me, and if you do get a chance to see it, it's out now on DVD. Pay attention to the last scene.
Absolutely good recommendation.
Okay.
A very good film, and a film I didn't even like as much as you, but no. I was tempted to put it on this list. It's so much about deception. A great film. A very good film, I should say. All right, my number four is Mike Hodges' Croupier, the Clive Owen film that made me want Clive Owen to be in every film, essentially. So cool in this. But plays a novelist who takes a job as a dealer in a London casino. He doesn't gamble at the tables, but he does gamble with all the other relationships in his life. There's great narration from Clive Owen in this, and you're not even sure what your relationship with him is as a viewer. You're not even sure necessarily if he's deceiving you. And so there's many, many opportunities for deception in this, and Clive Owen at the core of this just is a completely captivating and compelling character, so captivating you may fall for him in the same way some of the other characters do. And the way the movie sort of folds in on itself at the end, really powerful, really, really great film.
Yeah, Croupier is fantastic. My number four, I'm going with a movie that podcast listeners who have heard us talk about The Departed recently will know how much we like this film. It is Infernal Affairs, the Hong Kong film that inspired the Martin Scorsese remake, The Departed, which recently came out. And this, at its core, is this cat and mouse game between these two cops. One is a cop who is actually undercover as a criminal. One is a criminal who's undercover as a cop. The entire movie is about these two characters trying to find each other. And the scene in that film that works even better than it does in Scorsese's version, and there are a lot of things that I think work better ultimately, but there's a scene where they get a phone call from the other guy. They're trying to find each other. And this moment of tension when the phone rings and it's like, okay, who is on the other line? They know it has to be the guy because of the setup of the film, the way the plot is working, that it has to be the guy thereafter, but they just don't know who it's going to be, what the voice is going to be, what they're going to say. That tension is so palpable. It's great, and I love Infernal Affairs.
That's a great pick. I'm going to go right to another undercover cop movie. I honestly tried to eliminate the undercover cop genre as well, but we haven't done it in the top five, so
no.
It's fair ground. And I'm going with a really obvious choice. It is Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. You've got Tim Roth as Mr. Orange, the undercover cop who gets involved in a heist gone bad and gets a bullet in the stomach to boot. The test of loyalty, particularly at the core of that film between he and Harvey Keitel, is Mr. White, who has completely invested in this guy, invested in Mr. Orange, the undercover cop. He's certain that he can't be can't be the rat. He can't be the undercover cop. And that's just one element. And of course, you've got Roth. Some of my favorite scenes that when I go back and rewatch it, I feel like I'm always surprised by them, where we have the long sequences of him memorizing the monologue that will get him access to Lawrence Tierney's gang.
Yep.
Wonderful, wonderful, of course, famous Tarantino dialogue, but just brilliant kind of scenes that you don't think of that aren't really necessarily a part of the true story, the heist gone bad, the time we spend in the warehouse with these characters, but... Yeah, certainly all about deception there. You're cool. You're walking out the door for the first time meeting the gang. You're cool.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs, Sam. Yeah. I'm actually right here with you on this one. I almost called this the Mr. Orange Memorial List, but I have Reservoir Dogs as well at number three, and it's almost like you looked at my notes because seriously, of course, the ultimate deception is that relationship between Harvey Keitel and the fact that he is an undercover cop. And you're right, the emotional kind of resonance of him going, there's no way he's the cop. What are you talking about? And what he's willing to sacrifice because he so believes it. But really, it's those exact scenes. You're right. That's the deception that is also really interesting, is learning how to be deceptive. Those are the best scenes in Reservoir Dogs, the scenes I always remember, and the scenes that when I saw it for the first time when I was 18 or 19, excited me the most. Because I'd never really seen that before in an undercover cop movie, or at least I don't remember seeing it. And so that was the best, seeing that process of how do you become one of them.
Because it's about acting, too.
Yeah, it is.
It's really,
It's a Camone story. It's a scene, man. Memorize it.
What?
Look, man, an undercover cop's got to be Marlon Brando, right? To do this job, you got to be a great actor. You got to be naturalistic. You got to be naturalistic as hell. Because if you ain't a great actor, you're a bad actor. And bad acting is bullshit this job. Yeah.
What is this?
That's an amusing anecdote about a drug deal.
My number two, The Lady Eve. Preston Sturges. And you can say we tried to eliminate, I think, the con genre here. And you could certainly say that The Lady Eve is about a con. Certainly that's what Barbara Stanwyck is doing at the beginning of the film. She's trying to con Henry Fonda's millionaire brewer's son into letting go some of his money. And but really it becomes about the fickleness of love. And it's Stanwyck's second deception, where she comes in, I think it's the thinness of her disguise, which I love so much, where really all she's got is a pretty bad English accent and a whole lot of charm.
Uh-huh.
And it's Fonda's rationale for the similarity between this new woman, Lady Eve Sidwich, and his ex-love, his ex-fiance, is that it looks too much like his ex-fiance to be. They look too similar for it to be the same woman. And certainly, in terms of getting away with the deception by the skin of your teeth. I mean, maybe only Barbara Stanwyck in The Lady Eve could get away with
it. Yeah, great pick. I agree with you. I didn't like that movie as much as you did, but I love Barbara Stanwyck in that film, and it's a great choice for deception. My number two, I'm going to give the subject of our first review a little more love, Christopher Nolan,
nice.
Memento. Like Caché, it's about as mysterious and mind-bending as Caché, and it gets back to this idea of self-deception, I think. There's a lot of other deceptions going on, characters pretending to be someone they're not and having their own designs on manipulating our main character, Leonard. There's a lot of lies in this movie, but the fact is when you get down to the end of it, I'm not going to give anything away, but it's ultimately about a character deciding, I don't care what the truth is, or I don't really want to know the truth because I'd rather be happy. And this is my way to happiness. And it's all about accepting a lie in some way. And that, for me, is what makes Memento a film that isn't just a stylistic kind of masterpiece and very formally fun in the way that it's backwards, but emotionally powerful as well, is what happens, the kind of what the character accepts at the end about the human condition. Is really fascinating, I think.
Well, I think it's a pretty good transition to my number one, and it is Bernardo Bertolucci's The Conformist file under self-deception, just like really ultimately we learn that Guy Pearce's character in Memento chooses to do. And you have this character, you learn the lengths a character is willing to go to have what he terms a normal life. You know, he comes from this bohemian upbringing. His mother is kind of a drunk and a floozy. His father is dying of madness and syphilis in a hospital. He marries a woman that's no match for him intellectually. In fact, he has contempt for her, it seems. And not only that, he's willing to suppress his own idealistic perspective on life to join the Mussolini's fascist party, as we lead up to World War II. And it's really, the film is absolutely brilliant for a number of reasons, but in terms of what Trignon's, the lead character's, his motivations for suppressing everything that is happiness, for normality, and what he's willing to do relationship-wise, politically, and what that's based on, and how that unravels at the end.
Mm-hmm.
An incredibly, incredibly powerful film, and really ultimately lets us experience the downfall of deception in a way I don't think any of the other films on this list.
Yeah, I'm so glad to see it on your list. I love The Conformist. I love Bertolucci. And not only is Jean-Louis Trignon good in that film, but the female characters, Dominique Sanda and Stefania Sandrelli in that film, two of the most stunning and talented Italian actresses ever. They're really great. My number one film, I'm cheating, Sam. One of us had to have a cheat and have a tie in here, and I've got it. I've got two Hitchcock films, and so many of them could be about deception. They are. But my number one is a tie between Notorious and Vertigo. And I think that Vertigo is the masterpiece of the bunch. And certainly, that's what it's about. The main character, obviously, Kim Novak, leading Jimmy Stewart on this really parade of deception and lies. But I threw Notorious on there as well because it was one of the first films I thought of when we came up with this topic, because it's this idea of not necessarily the big lie, but these characters all just kind of lying to themselves and to each other about how they really feel. And that whole film is that tension of Ingrid Bergman having to go undercover herself and work for the government and pretend to love someone that she used to be with and no longer loves. But ultimately, for me, I love Cary Grant. I love Cary Grant in this role. And those little lies he tells himself and that behavior, the coolness that he has to exude to try to show how he really feels. He tries to cover up how he really feels, how he really is truly in love with Ingrid Bergman and just can't really afford to be. And the way he covers that up is for me, why Notorious is one of the first films that popped up on my list. So love both films. Hitchcock,
I'm
like
so
I said.
I'm so glad you mentioned Hitchcock. Otherwise, so we would have gotten a deluge
of emails.
I think, of
you're right.
Yeah. All right, well, that is our top five. Please send your top five or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a message. We'll be back next month with another top five and more reviews of new and recently released movies right here on Chicago Public Radio. In the meantime, go to filmspotting.net to listen to the weekly Film Spotting podcast.
And next week on the podcast, Sam and I will finish up our six-week documentaries marathon with Robert Epstein's The Times of Harvey Milk, and we'll also have reviews of Sofia Coppola's new movie Marie Antoinette and Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers.
Visit filmspotting.net for complete show archives, a calendar of upcoming reviews, and more. Also on the Film Spotting blog, sign up for The Dope Sheet, the Film Spotting weekly email blast.
This radio edition of Film Spotting is presented by Chicago Public Radio with editorial assistance from Christina Stevens and Joe Dassault. Our thanks to Todd Field, Ekta Farrar at New Line Cinema, and KUSC in Los Angeles for helping us arrange the Todd Field interview. And again, thanks to the Comfies and Livewire Recordings for tonight's music. For Film Spotting, I'm Adam Kempinar.
And I'm Sam Van Halgren. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by PeerFlix. Swap the DVDs you no longer watch for the ones you really want at peerflix.com/filmspotting. And by Dexter. Showtime presents the killer new series Dexter that the Chicago Sun-Times calls fantastic, a classic in the making, and People Magazine gives it 4 stars. By day, Dexter Morgan is a likable forensic investigator for Miami Homicide, but by night he dispenses a special kind of justice. Dexter, Sunday at 10, 9 Central, only on Showtime. To subscribe, call 1-800-SHOWTIME, or go to SHO.com.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Sam Van Halgren.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. On tonight's show, reviews of Christopher Nolan's The Prestige and Todd Field's Little Children. Reviews of Christopher Nolan's The Prestige and Todd Field's Little Children. I can't say it. I can't say Little Children.
What is wrong with you? What is that? That's a weird...
Children.
Children.
Little Children. It's hard with the L's.
Barbara Wawa.
Okay.